Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. We are online at commonwealthclub.org. It's in all caps there. On Facebook, Twitter, and check out our YouTube channel. I'm Dick Costolo, CEO of Chorus, and your moderator for today's program. It's my pleasure to introduce Nick Bilton, special correspondent for Vanity Fair and author of American Kingpin, The Epic Hunt for the Criminal Mastermind Behind the Silk Road. Nick is interested in the role of advancing technology and how it shapes society. He is a former columnist and reporter for the New York Times and contributor to CNBC. His in-depth columns and articles have led to investigations by the U.S. government. Nick has written three books, including the New York Times bestseller Hatching Twitter, which is currently being turned into a TV show for Lionsgate. Please help me in welcoming Nick Bilton to San Francisco.
Thank you.
So I think right away, the first question on the top of everybody's mind is, who's playing me in Hatching Twitter?
I think that we're gonna ask either you or I forget the guy's name from Superbad.
All right, okay, not like Sting or anyone like that.
Not Sting.
Okay, let's just dive right into the book. The obsession with secrecy on both the part of the employees of Silk Road, everyone involved with it, mm-hmm. and in fact, the obsession with
should we make sure people know what the Silk Road was?
Please, why don't you?
So, for those of you, I'm sure you've all shopped on there, but for the people that haven't, the Silk Road was a drug and guns and poisons marketplace where you could essentially buy anything, and it was started by this guy named Ross Ulbricht, who was a once a Boy Scout, and eventually became the guy who built and ran the site. And he went by the moniker, the Dread Pirate Roberts. And the way you got on the site was through Tor, the web browser, and you bought the things that Dick bought on there with Bitcoin. That's a good opening.
Yeah, so you've just mentioned a couple of the tools that they used to make sure they were protecting their privacy when they were doing these things. And yet, numerous, almost mistake after mistake after mistake in not thinking about privacy and secrecy along the way. As you did research for the book and tried to dig into how they thought about protecting what they were doing and protecting their identities and these almost ridiculous mistakes that they made along the way, just talk about that a little bit in terms of helping us understand all the players.
Well, the thing that's really interesting when you write a book is, especially a book like this, it's a true crime thriller, and it's not a tech book in any way, shape, or form, is that you take a story that that in federal investigators have spent years, gathering all this evidence and spreading out, and you have to kind of put it back together. It's almost like someone pulled a thread on a sweater and it fell off, and now you got to kind of re-sew it. And so you kind of get to see everything from this 10,000-foot view. And one of the things that I was able to see was that the people involved, all from the government and from Ross Ulbricht and the guys running the website, made just dumb mistakes. For example, and this is not giving away the book. None of this stuff actually will because of the way it's written. But he had left his email address on the internet. People had forgotten. Someone eventually did a Google search that found that. Another thing that Ross did that was truly fascinating was he had all these very strict rules. So if you worked for him, to ensure that you were not a federal agent, for example, you would have to send him your driver's license and so on. How do we know? How does he know that it's actually your driver's license? We don't know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, so he has everything encrypted in these folders on his computer, and he's super serious about his encryption. But his password is Purple Orange Beach. It's like that. There's all these things. So, and then the same thing was he had his employees to ensure that they hadn't been compromised if someone was arrested, they had these kind of code name things. So you would say, one question he would ask one of his employees was, if I ask you what's the weather like today, you say it's really cold and snowy, even if it's not. And so there were these systems set up. But at the same time, he's doing these things. He's got this. He's really, really into his security, and he's got people that are working for him that are managing all this stuff. And yet, he's accidentally saving millions of words of chat logs on his computer. So, you know, these are some of the mistakes that he made.
You mentioned that it's more of a true crime thriller than a tech book.
Yeah, it's in the true crime.
And like any good true crime thriller, the cast of characters in it is almost hard to believe. Talk about the character Variety Jones. So Variety Jones is this person who's initially selling seeds, I think. Weed seeds on the Silk Road, and becomes, without ever having met
him
in person.
I think he was selling weed seeds.
No, I'm trying to recall from the beginning, from the book. And becomes, without ever having met Ross, a mentor to Ross, and they develop this profound sort of almost father-son relationship. Just talk about this person, and who was he, and how did he get so close to this guy that was so worried about being ever caught?
Well, I think that it's interesting. So, you know, Ross lived a very private, he was very private in public. He didn't tell anyone about the site he was running, other than two people. He lived this kind of, it was incredibly insular, incredibly secretive life. But in private, online, he was incredibly public. You know, because he was on his computer, like most people in San Francisco, I guess, 18 to 20 hours a day, he was, you know, sharing everything on social media and engaging with people, you know, through the site, through chats, through forums. They had like Silk Road movie night where everyone all over the world on Silk Road would watch the same movie together and then comment on it. They had a book club. You know, I mean, he literally was running this drug and guns website like it was a college campus. And it's so fascinating because one of the people, you know, he starts the site with as this idea, like, what if you could make drugs legal, and would it make the world a safer place? And it's incredibly, and I truly do mean this, the initial goal is an incredibly altruistic one. Mm-hmm. He really thinks that if drugs were legal, these are some of the arguments he made at college. You know, he was in the Libertarian Debate Club, and he would say, if drugs were legal, people wouldn't die as a result of drug overdoses because they'd be, you know, you would know if this drug dealer sold bad drugs and you wouldn't buy them from them. There wouldn't be people that were dying in drug gun wars on the streets, things like that. And his argument was it's just like alcohol. And so that's how we start to cite it. And it explodes. It just becomes this giant thing almost immediately. And he has to manage it 24 hours a day. And so he eventually finds someone who helps him. And this guy, Variety Jones, who's got the greatest name in history of true crime stories, as far as I'm concerned. And Variety Jones tells him that he is a weed seed dealer from England who once lived in Canada, and that he is... He wants to be his mentor. He wants to ensure that this thing takes off, and he really truly becomes his mentor. He gives him pep talks. I remember I got access to all the chat logs for the book, so 2.1 million words of chat logs, and about 700,000 of them are just him and Variety Jones talking. And there's one point where Ross wants to expand. He wants to take just the Silk Road, and he wants to do a Masters of Silk Road, which would be like a Costco of drugs, so where you could buy like a ton of heroin rather than just a small bag of it. He wants to do a Silk Road pharmacy where you can buy pharmaceuticals, a Silk Road for guns, which was called the Armory, and he wants to do a Spanish version of the Silk Road, which is not in the book. But and Variety Jones yells at him, and he's like, "What the hell is wrong with you? Are you?" And he literally, quote unquote, "Are you Larry the Cable Guy or the next Steve Jobs?" And that's his inspirational talk to him, and they have these fascinating conversations, and they've never met. And they become the best of friends. And they get to a point where they're literally, you know, each night before they go to sleep, they're like, I love you, man, I'll see you. You know, it's like super bad when he's like, ba-doop, boop, at the end.
So
you and I used to do that, too.
Yeah, a long time ago. That was a long time ago. You agreed not to talk about that on stage.
Sorry.
So the shifting moral code, again, on both sides, both Ross, who starts out with this, as you said, very sort of almost idealistic way of thinking about it, and starts to change his views on things that are okay and things that aren't okay, but also the government agents investigating. Just talk about that. That was probably the thing that jumped out at me the most in the book, is the speed and ease with which people changed their moral positions about all this on both sides of the equation.
Well, I think it's interesting. So Ross, you know, the way the book is written, it's the chapters alternate. So one chapter, as you know, is a law enforcement agent, and there's four major law enforcement agents that you get introduced to as the story unfolds, and then a chapter about Ross or his girlfriend or something like that. And what I wanted to do, I didn't want to present a story. I didn't want to present an argument of what I thought, because I truly actually don't know what I think, even after I've written the book. I wanted to present an argument for both sides. So from Ross's side, it was he really truly believed that he could make the world a better place by building this website that would allow people to buy drugs. And his thought was that, you know, as I said before, that they would be good drugs, they wouldn't be bad drugs, that there would be less overdoses and so on and so forth. And I think that, you know, so he has this moment in the very beginning where he goes and he grows, he needs product, as we all need product in Silicon Valley. He needs product for his website.
To get it started.
Yeah. So he goes, I mean, he's an incredibly smart guy. He goes and he rents a little apartment, pays $450 a month, and he grows a huge thing of magic mushrooms. The irony is, like, there's these little funny parts of the book. He gets super into the show Breaking Bad while he's growing the mushrooms. So he's like literally growing the mushrooms and waiting for the gypsum to cure in the pressure cooker or whatever it is that you do. And he's like sitting there like with his shirt off because, you know, the temperatures in Austin in the middle of the summer watching Breaking Bad, which I thought was amazing. So he gets into these ideas of, he presents these ideas of the weed and mushrooms should be legal. I actually completely agree with him. I think the fact that, you know, if you look at medical records in the United States, there have been two recorded deaths from magic mushrooms. And it's not even clear in like the last 30 years. And it's not even clear if they were actual as a result of magic mushrooms. It was like a heart attack or something like that. And so when it comes to those things, the fact that people are being thrown in jail, you can completely see his point of view. But what happens is he creates this marketplace, and it's a free marketplace. And he wants anybody to be able to sell anything. And next thing you know, he's selling heroin, or he's allowing heroin to be sold and cocaine. And then it's guns. And then it's, you know, cyanide, because you can use that to clean gold. But the cyanide comes with a packet of instruction pamphlet of how to kill yourself. And his belief is, if you want to kill yourself, it is your choice to do that. The government should not tell you you can and cannot. And then it gets to a point where there's actually discussion in the chat logs between his employees. Someone wants to start selling body parts on the site. Livers, kidneys, things like that. It turns out, I think it's like an ounce of bone marrow costs like, you know, $60,000, whereas an ounce of cocaine is like $100, you know. A liver can go for several hundred thousand dollars, except if you're Chinese, it's actually $60,000. It's a lot cheaper for some reason on the black market. But anyway, so they have these discussions about those things. So the site goes from this very kind of altruistic thing to eventually becoming the thing where anything goes, and eventually leading to, you know, what happened next.
Along those lines, in Europe, you said you don't give your opinion in the book, but I'll ask you this now. Is Ross just a smart, mixed-up libertarian idealist who got in over his head, or is he a ruthless criminal mastermind?
You know, I could ask the same question about Travis Kalanick, who runs Uber. It's funny. So I
well, now you've done it.
Yeah. Dick's literally just going to be like, oh, no, I'm leaving now. No, I think that, you know, what's so fascinating when you look at the things that Ross wrote and you look at the things that Travis has written or any other, you know, startup founder, and not all of them, not you, Dick, don't worry. But a lot of
I looked away.
A lot of founders in the Valley, they, you know, so They read the same Ayn Rand books. You know, Peter Thiel quotes the same, you know, quotes of don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness. Or, you know, these are all the things that they all literally spoke the same exact language. Ross Ulbricht and a lot of the people that run these companies. And I think that they start out with this idea of, like, they look at something that is broken and they want to fix it. And it's great. But then they kind of go too far. And I think you could take Ross Ulbricht and you could say, I'm going to put you in charge of Uber, and you could take Travis and put him in charge of the Silk Road, and it would have been the same people in many respects. I don't know if Travis would have put out hits on people, which Ross did, but you know, maybe he would, I don't know. But they definitely have the same ideals, and they have this hunger to want to win at any cost whatsoever. And it's this libertarian idealism that kind of sets them off on that path.
You're talking a lot about Ross's side of the equation on the shifting moral code, but there's a lot going on the government side as well. Talk a little bit about that. Specifically, talk about Carl, DEA agent who gets involved in the case and then starts really. I mean, again, some of this stuff is straight out of what you would hope to uncover in a crime novel. It's the guy that starts playing both sides.
No, it's fascinating. I always grew up, I wanted to write fiction, and I've realized that nonfiction is way better, because if you wrote these things as fiction, no one would believe it. They'd be like, this is the dumbest story I've ever read in my life. That would never happen. But in the nonfiction world, it happens. And what happens with, the book essentially, in my opinion, is about ambition. It's about people that are ambitious and they want to prove something to themselves or to someone else, mostly to themselves, and that's what it becomes about. And with there are government agents all over that are looking for the founder of the Silk Road.
And not really helping each other.
No.
Going out of their way to not help each other. They can be the ones that find it.
Yeah, it's full on competition. It's people not sharing information, lying about the evidence they have, refusing to even tell the Department of Justice what they have because they're afraid that the FBI might be listening and steal it and go off and find their source or something. And so there's a guy from the IRS, his name Gary Alford. He's a totally bizarre character who reads everything three times, because he read at one point in his life that you only retain about 20% of what you read. So he figured if you read it three times, you retain 60%. And he literally reads everything three times, every email, every book, everything. There's an FBI agent, Chris Tarbell, who plays this game called What Would You Rather with everyone. I don't think I can actually say some of the games some of the questions he asks, but they're pretty disgusting.
Yeah.
These What Would You Rather games. Then there's this guy, Jared Duryagin, who's at the Department of Homeland Security, who's literally this like green newbie who collects Rubik's Cubes and can solve them in under a minute and carries them everywhere. They're on his keychains and his bags and everything. And then, of course, there's Carl Force of the DEA. And Carl Force was once a DEA agent who would go out and arrest guys and go undercover. And what happens was he used to go undercover, but he got a little too into the whole undercover thing, and he started doing the things that he was trying to stop. And he would like go and party with the drug dealers and get really drunk and end up sleeping with people and all this stuff. And he eventually gets pulled over for DUI while he's undercover and gets a desk job and whatever. So anyway, he reasons when he starts to do the Silk Road investigation that he won't get sucked in that way. And of course he gets sucked in,
of course,
in a way that is so epic. It's unbelievable. He starts creating pseudonyms and starts selling information to the Dread Pirate Roberts, is Ross's pseudonym. He does fake murders. He's like buying and selling Bitcoin. He's like he becomes an incredibly unethical bizarre character in the story.
Before we dive into some of the audience questions, there's some great ones here. There are discrepancies in the stories you hear in researching, you know, any book. I remember you asking me in the few questions you had for me about rehashing Twitter, you know, tell me about the morning you became CEO and so. And I said, well, I walked in and XYZ happened. And you said, no, I hear you met with so-and-so. And was innocuous to the story, but
talk
about, in this kind of story, the discrepancies must have been immense. Talk about some of them and how you determined or decided, you know, what probably happened.
Well, it's interesting. So I remember I told Dick this once. For the Twitter book, I asked Jack Dorsey where he was on the morning he was fired. And he said, I remember I left the office, and I remember like it happened 5 minutes ago. And I walked outside, and I met with Biz Stone, and we sat in the park right near the tea shop. And it was a beautiful day out, and I remember distinctly. And so I asked Biz, and he said, oh, my God, it was raining. We were in the Whole Foods, and we had soup. I remember he had this vegetable soup. I cannot forget that vegetable soup.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, how the hell am I supposed to figure that out? And eventually what I actually did was I went and looked at the weather almanac for that day. And it turned out it was raining. It's not something to lie about.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to lie about where you sat for a conversation.
Sure.
You know, our memories are fallible. Yeah. They, you know, we forget things. We you know, but on the internet, the internet doesn't.
Right.
And what I found so fascinating about this book was that the trove of information that Ross left behind, and anyone, all of them, Variety Jones, even some of the agents, you know, through chat logs, photos, social media posts, videos, cell phone, text messages, emails, blah 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 blah. All these things that we were. I have a researcher I worked with in LA, and we built this kind of like Excel database where we put everything in a timeline, and we could take the chat logs, and we could take Ross's social media feed, we could take photos, and we could look and cross correlate. And what was so fascinating was, you know, the Dread Pirate Roberts would say, "I'm going away for the weekend," and put one of his employees in charge of the site. And at that same moment, you would see a photo with a timestamp of Ross getting into his friend's car to go camping for the weekend. And then the timestamp of them getting back, like driving back over the Golden Gate Bridge, and then the Dread Pirate Roberts locking on and talking about how he had a great weekend. He met this girl that is in the photos. And that happened so many times. The documents didn't lie. Where things kind of got a little hairy is where they always get hairy with any story that is about a success, and it's with the law enforcement side, because everyone thought that they were the one that figured it out. But as with everything, it's everyone in the room that helps and plays a role.
It's remarkable how close they are to taking him down so many times.
Yeah.
And
there's some stories that don't make it into the book that are pretty wild. Like there's one moment when the DEA... you know, with Carl Forrest and his crew, they kind of treat it like Carl Forrest actually looks exactly like the brother-in-law in Breaking Bad. What's the guy's name again? I swear to God, yeah, Hank. Every time I think of Carl Forrest, I think of Hank. They like kind of love the whole like DEA thing, you know, and they're like DEA agent, and so they find a server. That they think belongs to the Dread Pirate Roberts, and they decide it's some professor's house that he doesn't know what's on the server. He just rents out server space. They go in like guns drawn, smash the door down, almost kill the cat, and they pick up one server and put it over here, and then they grab the other server and they take it with them, and that server had at one point in time been part of the Silk Road. But it had been wiped clean. The server they had picked up had the whole Silk Road on it, and they just didn't even know. Like, so there's all these instances of moments. There's so many of moments like that where they almost get them and then they don't.
From the audience, is there any doubt in your mind that Ross is guilty?
There is not a shred of a droplet of a minuscule thread of a hair of a doubt that it was him all along. Variety Jones did some bad things in the respect of, you know, he was a very interesting character.
They catch all these guys. They catch this guy too. I mean, this guy, Variety Jones.
And this is not giving away the story in the book. Believe me, this is really not. There's 300 and something people that end up arrested in the end. But Variety Jones is really fascinating because he comes up with this idea one day and he messages Ross, and he says, and at this time Ross had been going by the name Silk Road Admin on the website. And he said, I have an idea. Variety Jones has an idea. And he's in his apartment in London, and he's got Variety Jones is a fascinating character. He's got multiple sclerosis. He's so smart, way smarter than anyone I've ever read on the internet. He's just really like always has a quip for everything. He's funny, he's clever, knows things that you're just like, how did you know that? So he says to Ross, he says, I have an idea. He says, have you ever seen The Princess Bride?
Yeah.
And Ross is like, yeah, I know The Princess Bride. And he says, you know the story of the Dread Pirate Roberts? And he says, yeah. He goes, it's the story about the guy who's the Dread Pirate Roberts, and then after a few years, he retires and gives it to someone else, and no one knows who the real Dread Pirate Roberts is. And Variety Jones says, you need to become the Dread Pirate Roberts. And he says, in that way, if you ever want to retire from the site, get another Dread Pirate Roberts. What Ross didn't know was Variety Jones, who we call him VJ, the people called him VJ on the site, VJ did that because he actually wanted to take over one day. And so there was an ulterior motive for it. But what ends up happening is, you know, VJ does some really bad stuff. He entices Ross to put a hit out on someone. At one point, he's pushing him to sell guns and all these other things. He's adamantly against heroin, though. He thinks it's really bad. He doesn't think he should sell heroin. But that concept of the Dread Pirate Roberts was the defense for Ross in court. It was if he'd have called him like, you should call yourself the Easter Bunny.
Yeah.
Like if he would never have been able to say there are multiple Easter bunnies. It's like, no, there's one Easter Bunny.
Yeah.
But because it was the Dread Pirate Roberts, it was perfect. But when you look at these millions of words of chat logs and Ross's his social feed, and he's going to Dominica, you know, he goes to Dominica at one point to try to get a citizenship there so he can stash his money and live there in case he's on the run. He's living in San Francisco in a Craigslist apartment under a pseudonym of some random name, paying $1,200 a month in cash and ordering fake IDs under his roommate's name and trying to get it. And there's all these things that he does throughout the entire thing, but there is nothing more damning than the stuff that was found on his computer that ties him to being the Dread Pirate Roberts the entire time.
How did he marry his, talked around this a little bit, but talk about how he rationalized or married his supposed altruism and ideals with the deaths that he himself contracted via the website. There's the libertarian drug, everyone should be able to, you know, do magic mushrooms, and then there's the paying somebody to have somebody killed.
Well, so when I first started the reporting, which we've all done, I mean, come on, you know. When I first started doing the reporting for the book, that's the part where I was like, maybe there was more than one Dread Pirate Roberts. Maybe there was. And then, you know, all these things started to tie together, and I was like, well, maybe he was schizophrenic. I don't know. Maybe, what was going on? And so I eventually ended up tracking down a bunch of people he went to college with. And Ross went to Penn State. He was going to be a physicist. And he got really into the libertarian club. He was doing debates with the college Republicans and the college Democrats and so on. And I remember I got some audio of some of the debates. Like there was some newspaper clippings of them and things like that. And I found some people that had been in the debate club with him, and I said, "What's the justification? There's no way that he would have done that." And they said, "Actually, if you go and read the books he was reading at that point in time, the hardcore, you know, Mises, Austrian economic books, they actually do say that killing someone is perfectly okay if they harm your own personal property." And this is the line that the Dread Pirate Roberts uses when he's discussing this with his employees. And I think that I can't definitively say, but I do think that what was going through his mind at that point was this: I am on this journey. He really, truly does believe the whole time that he's going to save the world by legalizing drugs and prove that they should be legal. And I think he thought having one employee killed is just the price I have to pay for this greatness that I'm gonna pull off.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Great question from the audience. Are there any lessons from the Silk Road case that tell us anything about how decentralized cyber criminal organizations operate? In other words, did the government, like, do they have a lot of takeaways from this that are, aha, here's how we should deal with these things going forward?
We should have asked James Comey before he was fired tonight.
Today. We missed our chance by two hours.
By the end of this session, I think there'll be someone else. They'll have painted the White House pink or something like that. I think that the thing that's been really fascinating is that, you know, a lot of people think, and this is the first chapter in the book, a lot of people think that the Silk Road, that the government wanted to take it down because of the drugs. And that wasn't actually the first reason. And it wasn't even the biggest reason. The main reason that they went after it originally, this HSI agent, he had this realization. He 9/11 had been a big thing for him. His dad was a judge, and there's a whole backstory there. But he believed that what happened on 9/11 was that the terrorists used American-built planes and the American-built airline system to crash planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And they didn't need weapons. And what Jared Yeagan, the HSI agent, thought, he saw the Silk Road from a single, literally a single pink pill that had come in through Chicago O'Hare. And I visited Chicago O'Hare, a little tangent here. I visited Chicago O'Hare Airport and I got to see where the mail and the drugs come in. And the mail facility is like 20 football fields big, and the fact that this little tiny pink pill was discovered was pretty amazing. But so anyway, he sees this pink pill come in, and he discovers the Silk Road, and he thinks to himself, he's like, whoa, someone could use the site not for the drugs, but terrorists could come into this country just on a vacation, and then they could go on the Silk Road with Bitcoin, and they could buy the guns and the other weapons that are available without even entering a store or anything, ever trying to figure out how to get them, and they could do something using the American-built internet, the American-built Tor, and so on to cause harm. And I think that, to answer the question, the agents I've spoken to have told me that they kind of try to look at these things, these new things that come about, these new technologies, and try to look at the negative side of them. Sorry, I have a little cough. I'm going to take some medicine.
Does Roth deserve to, again, you talk about this, and we talked about this backstage. Does Roth deserve two life sentences in prison?
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm asking you. I'm working on my midpoint program reminder. So you answer the question, and I'll read the reminder after that.
So,
I don't know.
I don't know the answer to that question. Sorry, I'm going to spit this out.
Maybe talk about, though, the way the judge thought about that.
So I'm asked that question.
Someone who
that is literally
thinks about
if
thought
you,
about
you can
it
ask me any question about the Silk Road, Ross Ulbricht, Variety Jones, I'll be able to tell you whatever. When it comes to that question of does he deserve two life sentences plus 40 years, I don't know the answer. And the reason is because he is someone who did some bad things. You know, there were people that died as a result of the site. There were kids that overdosed. There were lots of things that happened that were really, really bad. But
along those lines, there's a great scene in the book, and maybe talk about this a little bit as well, just because it paints the picture. Instead of glossing over kids that died, there's a great scene in the book where he's sort of away on this camping trip, and there's horrific things happening on the other side of the world as a result of what he's doing.
Yeah, so he's I'll answer this question after I tell that. So there's a point. So when you're reading the book, you'll kind of see that there's this. It's fun. It's like he's like building the site. He's growing the mushrooms. He's watching Breaking Bad. It's like, and then the site's growing, and he's making all this money. He doesn't even know what to do with it. He's got so much money. It's like millions of dollars on his laptop. He can't even launder it quick enough. The graphs on his computer are showing sales, like projected $1 billion sales for 2014 and so on. And he goes away for a weekend and he goes camping and he meets a girl and falls in love. That chapter of him doing that, I juxtapose it with the exact same weekend that a kid, a 16-year-old kid, and I spent time with the family of the kid, got access to what's called NBOM, N-B-O-M, and it's a synthetic drug that's like acid, but it's made in these Chinese labs. And people, they bought them off the Silk Road, and the kid has a, they're so strong, the kid freaks out and dies. He literally jumps off a balcony and dies. And when you read that chapter, it's like my sister was reading the book early on, an early version of it, and she was like, she said like that was like a punch in the stomach because mm-hmm. she was like, holy shit, this thing is real. Mm-hmm. And people are actually being harmed by it. And so for that, I remember talking to the parents, and that was for me a kind of like a change of you know, I got Ross's point of view from all the reporting I did, but then at that point you see he's away, he comes back, he logs onto his computer and he says, you know, how did everything go on the site this weekend? And mm-hmm. and his employees are like, it was great, because every time he goes away, something bad happens, like hackers try to take over the site, or like they knock it offline, he has to pay them a ransom of $100,000, all these things that go wrong. And it's like the first weekend, nothing goes wrong. And his employee says, it was great. It's as if the curse has been lifted. And like literally as his employee is saying that, this kid is being pulled off life support. And I think that it's, you know, when you see hear those stories, and there are lots of them, when you hear those stories, it makes you think maybe he did deserve the sentence he got.
Talk a little bit about the judge in the case.
Yeah, so the judge, one of the things that's been, it's been interesting. So when you write a book or a magazine article, whatever, you get some pushback from people. I've experienced that a couple of times in my life.
Don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And with this book, you know, there are a lot of people that support Ross, and I get why. You know, their arguments are that he, you know, there's prostitution that happens on Craigslist. Do we take Craig and throw him in jail? There are things that are, you know, Facebook, people buy guns on Facebook. Do we arrest Mark Zuckerberg as a result? I think that the difference is that Mark didn't start Facebook to sell guns, and they do make somewhat of an effort to try to stop them from being sold, especially after they've been covered in the press. There's a group it's called the Free Ross Group, and they haven't read the book. I can tell from the things they say, but they come after me on the internets, as people do on Twitter, actually. I think the thing that's really fascinating is like I think a lot about a moment. I went to I covered the trial for the New York Times, and I was there most of the time. And during the sentencing of Ross, the judge had a really tough time. This was the first case ever like this that they had to sentence someone for, and for running a website, a drug website online. And the judge said, you know, I spent 100 hours thinking about what the sentence should be. I spoke to people, I read the chat logs, I read 70-something letters from your friends and family about how good of a person you are. And she says, you know, I think people are complicated, and that there is good in you and there is also bad, and that what you did was very destructive to society. And she said, your argument, and this is the part that actually makes me angry about the Free Ross crowd, is that she said, your argument that you come into this court and say that you should have a lesser sentence because you did what you did from behind a computer is an argument of privilege. It's a white argument, essentially, is what she's saying. She didn't use that word, but she said, you know, I sat in that courtroom and I saw her sentence someone during a break. It was a black guy from the Bronx, and he got, you know, 30 years for selling cocaine, and his family, his kids were there crying and everything. And she said, and he didn't see that, of course, but I had seen that. And she said, you know, what your argument is an argument of privilege. Someone from the Bronx who sells drugs doesn't get to come into my court and say that they were doing it for, you know, and I think the thing that's frustrating is I do believe that the judicial system in America is incredibly broken. And it's actually, a lot of it is Bill Clinton's fault, believe it or not. The drug laws are diabolical. The fact, if you look at the number of blacks and Hispanics that are in jail for drugs, it's really, really sad. And the fact that this group of people is not standing up for those people, I think is the part that's the most upsetting when you hear their responses to things.
Along those lines, And I wondered this myself, question from the audience. Did you fear for your safety at all during the process, especially while you were investigating some of these folks who would rather not be investigated?
Yeah, I mean, Variety Jones was a little scary. I spoke to people who had interviewed him early on for previous stories. He tells stories about like shootouts in Texas and, you know, and ruining people's lives through the internet and stuff like that. And I've had a few threats, some serious ones that have been reported to the police. But it's the job, you know, it is what it is. I think that this is a really important story. And most of the people involved, I don't think are going to show up at my front door. If they will, they'll meet Pixel, the guard dog. But you know, it's a story.
Showered with affection.
There's a moment where Jared is the jig and the HSI officer. He's taking over in the story. He's taking over this user's account, and he's going to become undercover. As this woman, she's like, I'm really scared, and he's like, don't be. He's like, they're not, you know, like these, all the agents got threats and people got, you know, like emails and letters and, but at the end of the day, like, I don't, you know, if you're going to come after me, like you've got bigger problems. If I'm the guy you're coming after.
What are your
thoughts?
Judge
did actually have some problems. Somebody on a forum, posted her like social security number and email and said something really vile about her, about how she should be murdered and whatnot, and they had to have like metal detectors put in the courtroom and stuff like that. So,
I've got a great question here on some more moral relativism. But first, so the Silk Road is gone. Talk about what came after it. Is it like Napster? It's Silk Road 2.0 and flourishing more than ever and harder to catch, and they've fixed their mistakes.
Yeah, there's a website called Twitter that came after it.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks, folks. I'll be here for 24 more minutes. There's actually a number of Silk Roads. There's a Silk Road 2 that got taken down. The guy that was interesting.
It's actually called Silk Road 2.
It was called Silk Road 2. They copied all the stuff.
Might have been a mistake.
Put it up in a couple of weeks. And the guy who ran it, Blake Blenthal or something like that, he was. The thing with Ross Ulbricht, while he did have millions and millions of dollars on him when he was caught, tens of millions of dollars, he was not flashy. He literally, the FBI, they found $2 in his pocket. He was still wearing the same clothes that his girlfriend had bought him at Penn State 5 years earlier.
But I guess to summarize the question that I just asked is, I'll say it another way, who learned more lessons more quickly, the government side or the Silk Road side?
The Silk Road side, without question. But I was going to say, so Blake was caught. He was driving a Tesla. He was being very flashy with his money, so he got caught. And then there was a Silk Road 3, which has not been taken down, as far as I'm aware, or maybe it got taken down. It's back up. And then there are just tons of others. There's Valhalla. There's, but they what they do now is they specialize in different things, and a lot of them are based in Russia and China, where you can't ask Vladimir to take them down. But they, you know, the government is having a much more difficult time taking down these other sites, and I don't think that you're going to put the genie back in the bottle.
Back to the moral relativism that permeates the book.
Yeah.
Do you think that in today's society we're losing this notion of moral versus immoral, the value of the common good over the this is the best thing for me above all else? And talk about, you know, you mentioned earlier on there's a sort of a libertarian thread that runs through Silicon Valley. Let's talk about whether you think that's infected the population and is infected the right word and so forth.
You know, I think that I struggle with this every day, and I'm curious. I'm actually really curious to hear what you think too. But I think that the internet, I don't know if it's done more good than it has bad. I feel like it's amazing that we can connect with each other from thousands of miles away, and that we can, you know, develop, you know, we can help drive democracy in the Middle East and things like that. But there are so many bad things that come as a result of it. I have a column I wrote today from Vanity Fair about how, you know, I was envious of France this weekend that they voted not just for a sane human being, but that they didn't let the email hacks affect their judgment. And in America and in England, the media and social media and all these things completely have distorted, you know, our, we've let them kind of tell us what to think. And I think that it's funny, I work in media, but I think it's a really gross industry for the most part. And there's people like Sean Hannity and even on the other side, you know, that take advantage of the system. And I think social media kind of magnifies that. And you look at the good sides of the internet, and then there are, to me, there are some pretty bad ones too. And so I think that what I wonder is, when you look at technology going forward, is there a way that it can be used to try to bring some more calm to society and more reason, or is it just going to continue to spiral in the way it has? What do you think?
I think that with or without technology, there's been a remarkable erosion of discourse. Just think about TV alone. Without the internet, the news networks have become, these are the people that think what I think and will tell me what I want to hear, and those are the people that say what they think and will tell those people what they want to hear.
Yeah.
And rarely do they cede any ground.
Yeah. And I think that I don't think that that's going away. You know, France does not have a Sean Hannity. They chose not to cover those emails. You know, and there was this responsibility.
They do. They just don't put them on TV.
No, they did. Yeah, they do have a Sean Hannity. But I think there's a responsibility that America could use to learn a little bit of.
There's a couple questions about this, and I confess to not actually being very familiar with it, but hopefully you'll know what the references do. Can you address the article on cell phone risks for the New York Times, and what kind of harassment you got for that, and what kind of
whoever answered that question? Follow-up.
There were several of them.
I'm just kidding. I've gotten, this has nothing to do with the book. I wrote an article about cell phones, wearable computers and cancer. And there's a backstory to it, which was that an editor had said, hey, we keep hearing all these stories about how, you know, cell phones could cause cancer, but all these wearables are going to come out. We're going to stick them on our body. Isn't that weird? Like, we should look into that. And I was like, okay, cool. I'll look into doing a column on it. And of course, the Apple Watch had not come out yet. And it's amazing, actually. This was like 2 years ago that some people still remember these things. It's crazy. I'll tell you the whole story here. So I got a phone call one day, it was from someone who, it was from my stepfather, and he said, your mother has 2 weeks to live. She's got cancer. And so I went to England. She literally had 2 weeks to live. And I didn't write a column for 3 weeks. And she passed away, very sudden. And I felt bad that I hadn't written anything for 3 weeks. And my editor was like, you know, do you want to write something? And I was like, you know what? I had this thing on the back burner. Let me just write it. It's kind of relevant to what's going on. And so I wrote the piece. And the way reporting works, and any journalist that tells you otherwise is full of shit, is when you're trying to get you want quotes for a story, you call a number of different people, and it's usually whoever answers the phone first that you end up quoting. They're all experts and so on. And there was one guy I quoted, this guy Joseph Mercola, who apparently is an anti-vaxxer, but had written extensively on cell phones and cancer. And anyway, I quote him as saying some things I actually forget. And the column goes out, and the column goes up, and I literally get in the car to go to my mother's funeral, and Twitter blows up. And Gawker writes something about it, and next thing you know, like, every single outlet on planet Earth is writing something about it. And I'm a trending topic in, like, Czechoslovakia and people were, and you know, I was told that I was the worst person that had ever walked the face of the earth because I had quoted this guy and that the story was wrong. However, if anyone would have bothered to look through the archives of the New York Times, they would see that not only has he was he a New York Times bestseller? Which in the New York Times rules, you're allowed to quote someone if they're a bestseller, it makes them an expert and so on. But that we had written that same story about cell phones and cancer and us not knowing, which is what the story said, that we don't know, but we should just be careful anyway. We'd written that same story in the science section, in the health section, in the national section over the last 20 years, but people still like to talk about it for whatever reason.
You're still a trending topic in Czechoslovakia, Nick.
Thank you. Like four people tweeting there.
All right. When, back to the book.
Yep.
It's really one of those chapter after chapter, you know, you'll read something and think, you've got to be kidding me. As you were researching this,
yep,
what were the things that, of all the shocking stories along the way and of the Silk Road and Ross, what were the things that you just you know, were almost hard to believe when you stumbled upon them?
I think the thing that was so hard to believe was that you could, that what I could find out about someone. I mean, I'll tell you some stories.
Talk about a couple of
like,
those.
Can I? You have the book right there. Can I just see it for 1 second? There's.
I have one up here.
Let me see if I can find this chapter, and I'll just give you an example of when.
Would you like me to stall for time?
Yeah, you could just tell a story about how much you. I can't find it. Okay, here we go. 187. 187 homicide. Okay. So this is the chapter 44, camping in the bowl. And there's a point where Ross, so he's leaving town, and so I'll just read this page.
Yep.
San Francisco temperature had clung to the high 40s for most of the day, yet Ross was dressed as if he were going to the beach, not up north for a two-day hike in the wilderness. His fellow campers had planned appropriately. Selena, whose birthday they were celebrating, was bundled up in woolly socks and a thick scarf. Renee was wrapped in thick layers, like a piece of precious porcelain about to be shipped in the mail. And Crystal, Selena's sister from Portland, looked like she was going camping in the Antarctica. And so I kind of go through this whole thing, and then I talk about how they go across the Golden Gate Bridge, and Ross looks over at the at Alcatraz to his right, and they go up to Mill Valley, and I talk about their in Sausalito and so on and so forth. And I talk about everything. I never spoke to one of those people ever.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But so here's how I found that stuff. So there was I found a photo of Ross when he was going camping in the EXAF data. It has the timestamp. It has
sort of the metadata
in the photo. It has the timestamp. Sometimes they have GPS, sometimes they don't. So I can see what they're all wearing. I can look at the timestamps of when they took the photo from in front of their house, when they took it at the Golden Gate Bridge, when the photo was taken of Alcatraz. I can look at photos of when they get to the campground, when they're unloading the car, when they're skipping through the thing, when they're on the hillside, when they're swimming in a dam. And you can say, okay, so I have all that stuff, so I can tell you this story, right? Very, very detailed. I look at the weather almanac online. I look at the direction of the sun. There's like apps that you can use so you know if they were standing in the shadow or if they weren't. And then I use, I look at the timestamps and I say, okay, I don't know where they went camping. It's not labeled, right? There's a photo of all their food, so I know what they ate, so I can describe that. But it's like an hour and 22 minutes from when they pass the Golden Gate Bridge to when they get to the campground. So, okay, 60 miles an hour, traveling this distance, you're probably going to get here. So I start looking around, like, north of Sausalito and on Google Maps, and there's the dam, and there's the road, and there's the... And so I didn't know anything. And then with the GPS data and the EXAF photos, you can start to kind of figure out where they went. So I can go there. I can see what the gravel looks like. I can sit on this. I do these things. It's kind of obsessive, but like, and it's so fascinating that you can write something that feels like it's fiction from these photos and things like that. And it got to a point where like I was figuring out like people's, you know, home addresses and phone numbers from just a photo and the first name, which was kind of terrifying.
Who are the heroes on the government side in this? There's a lot of, I mean, again, you've touched on a thin layer of it. There's a lot of bad behavior on the government side of the investigation. Who are the heroes? Are there heroes?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think, you know, there are heroes and there are bad guys on both sides. And I think everyone is a hero and a bad guy at the same time. That you know, Variety Jones hates heroin and he believes it shouldn't be sold on the site. He's okay with guns. He's okay with cocaine. He's okay with poisons, but heroin's, and he tries to stop it. And the same thing, you know, on the government side, you've got the FBI agents and Jared Yeagan, the DHS agent, and so on. And you know, that I think that they all do something that they probably shouldn't, by like maybe not sharing information to this and the other, and they all do something that they, something good. So, and I think that that's the case with the entire story. There's a good side and a bad side to everything.
So a specific question about the murder for hire allegations. Why do you think they, or why were the murder for hire allegations deemed admissible and not prejudicial?
The murder for hire allegations were actually, there's some confusion about the murder for hire allegations. So they were actually filed in Baltimore, but Ross was tried in New York, and Ross was actually given a plea deal. A lot of people don't know about this. He was given a plea deal, and he probably, the plea deal was going to be like 10 to life with a recommendation of a lower sentencing, and he didn't, he decided not to do it, and he decided to fight the case. And the government said, if you fight this case, we're going to throw the kingpin charge at you. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of people in the history of America that have been charged with the kingpin charge. It's a charge that's designed for like mafioso bosses who run an organization but never get their hands dirty. The guy in Brooklyn, I forget his name. What was that? Yeah, Gotti. He was like the kingpin charge. I think was actually started for him or someone like him. But that was an example. And so, but the kingpin charge actually encompasses pretty much everything. And a lot of people that try to kind of defend Ross in the case say, "Yeah, well, he was never charged with murder." Well, he actually was in Baltimore, and had the case failed in New York, they probably would have charged him with the murder in Baltimore. But at the same time, they didn't actually go through with it yet. But at the same time, the kingpin charge, they referenced it in the sentencing, they referenced it at the trial dozens of times. And so just because he wasn't charged with it doesn't mean that it wasn't something that the government, you know, included in their list of things that he had done wrong.
Ross has a girlfriend who you've said is a real character.
Julia.
She is convinced that he's not doing what he's doing. She's naive. She is willfully ignoring obvious things that are going on. Talk about her. Talk about that. I was surprised at how long she sort of was willing to accept this notion that I don't know. That's not me.
Someone asked me, they were like, why did you put the story of Ross and his girlfriend in the book? And I said, because that's the most important part, in my opinion. It's, you know, here he is, he's running this website where they're selling, you know, Glock 9s and cyanide and heroin and fentanyl. And he's like going on OkCupid dates, you know. I mean, literally, like if it's OkCupid profile. And like, this is a funny story. I'll get back to the girlfriend. There was a, this is actually one of my favorite little stories that didn't really make it into the book, but I knew someone who had gone, a friend who had gone on a date with a guy, and she was complaining that all the guy was talking about was Bitcoin and like digital currencies the whole time, and he was like a weird guy, and like the date sucked. They
had
met on
libertarian ideals.
Had all these libertarian ideals, and when I eventually got to talk to some of the agents, the FBI had been trailing Ross for a couple of weeks, and they had followed him when he'd gone on a date, and they sat next to him in some sushi restaurant in the Mission, and they were listening, and he was like talking about, and it turned out it was the girl had gone on a date with Ross that I knew, so which is pretty funny. I mean, look, you know, Julia fell in love with Ross, and you know, she was trying to. She didn't have a problem, and I think, look, if he'd have done the site and it was just weed and mushrooms, I think we'd all be sitting there saying, like, good for him. Like, you know, like, those are silly things that shouldn't go, people shouldn't go to jail for. But you know, when it started to kind of escalate and get out of control, she started to get really worried, and they used to get into these debates all the time. And she started like having panic attacks, and she thought like she would go to the grocery store, and she would think someone was a cop, and eventually it ended their relationship. But the breaking point to her was the guns. That was when she was like, this is not normal. So,
all the way zooming way back out. What you write it, the various things you've written about. Why did you decide to write this story, the Silk Road story? I know after your second book, you were spending a lot of time thinking about what's the right next topic. How did you land on this story?
I think that stories don't find stories, they find you. And that's been the case with all of the big stories that I've done, and especially the last two books that I've done. The Twitter book was a complete accident. I had written a book proposal called The New Kings about like a dozen people in the Valley that were going to be the next Rockefellers and so on, and my book agent was like, this is the worst proposal I've ever read, but I do like this chapter, this one on Twitter. What about the Twitter book? And so I was like, oh man, I guess we could try that. I don't know if anyone would read that, but then I started kind of reporting it, and it led to a book. And with this, I used to live in Glen Park, where Ross was eventually arrested, and I used to walk Pixel, the attack dog. I would walk her to the park, and I remember I would walk by this library every day that I would walk her. And I always remember thinking, like, who goes into that little library? And there was a coffee shop next door, which I would go and I would work from sometimes. And then eventually Ross is arrested in the library. And it was so crazy to me that I went to there's moments in the book where he's at the sushi restaurant, he's at this diner, this coffee shop, this grocery store that I went to, and I was like, whoa, this guy is running the biggest drug website the internet has ever seen.
He's sitting next to me in the coffee shop.
And the fact that I wouldn't have known, like if you showed me a picture, I would never know it could have been anyone that was in that coffee shop. That for me was really fascinating.
Please join me in thanking Nick Bilton for joining us here tonight in San Francisco. Nick is here with his new book, American Kingpin, and we'd like to remind the audience here that copies of American Kingpin are for sale, and Nick will be happy to sign your copy in the fireside room at the end of the hall. I'm Dick Costolo, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.